The Media Report, broadcast throughout Australia on ABC Radio National and across the Asia Pacific on Radio Australia. I'm Anthony Fennell. And just a reminder that you can also access the program as either streaming audio or as a podcast, simply by visiting our website, abc.net.au/rn/media report. And while you're there, why not have your say on our guest book? In Australia, Britain and the United States, moves are currently underway to increase the surveillance powers of law enforcement agencies. In the States last month, a court decision made clear that US authorities now have the right to monitor the web browsing behaviour of ordinary citizens without the need for a warrant. Kenneth Farrell is from the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. I caught up with him recently while he was visiting Australia. He's been busy comparing and contrasting the surveillance practices of government authorities and companies in both the US and its growing international rival, China. And he says while many Americans wouldn't like to admit it, there are a lot of similarities between the way the authorities in both nations actually surveil their populations.
I looked at three different dimensions: the legal dimensions, the dimensions of technology, how it affords particular kinds of surveillance, and the actual practices that were going on in China. What I found, for example, on the legal dimension, we understand U.S. law to be fairly well evolved and the Chinese law to be very immature. Chinese law has a few aspects. There are a few articles, for example, in their criminal law, which prevent the unreasonable search of private homes and of email, and of regular public mails. But these laws don't really apply to the law enforcement agencies. They can, on their own authority, generate warrants and go and investigate people. So the law in China doesn't really protect people from the surveillance of the state. But we do have an assumption that the U.S., for example, the U.S. Fourth Amendment, which is the Fourth Amendment of our Bill of Rights, it prevents the search of one's home and personal effects without a court-ordered search warrant. And this has been a very important law in protecting U.S. privacy for many years. Ever since the dawn of electronic communication, particularly with the popularization of the telephone, the Fourth Amendment has run into certain trouble the way it's interpreted in the courts. There was a very famous case in 1934, Olmsted versus the United States, where Olmsted brought the police to court saying that their tapping of his telephone from outside his home and listening in on his personal conversations was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. And the interesting court decision at that time was that although the judge felt perhaps the police's actions were not morally correct, that the wording of the Fourth Amendment was very specific, and that they did not go through the walls of this person's home to search his effects or to look at what was going on in his house. Because of that fact, they threw the case out of court. And for the next 30 years, it was understood that the Fourth Amendment did not apply to telephone conversation. And that has changed somewhat. In the late 60s, case Katz versus the United States came up with the concept of the reasonable expectation of privacy. And this meant that if an American citizen had a reasonable belief that the conversation that he was engaging in with someone, whether it was inside their home or on a street corner, or whether they were talking on the telephone, if they reasonably believed that their conversation should be private, then they were then protected by the Fourth Amendment. And people viewed this as progress, but in the intervening 30-some-odd years, as we move our conversations and communication to mediated means, such as the internet, we find that even the reasonable expectation clause really doesn't apply so well to the internet. For one, it becomes easier and easier for people to eavesdrop on conversations, whether it's a private corporation or the state itself. And then the question becomes, well, is it even reasonable to think that your email should remain secure? And there are a number of interesting cases going on, one in the U.S. right now called U.S. versus Warshak, where the position of the U.S. Justice Department is that any time you use a third-party email service, such as Gmail or MSN, your mail is really the equivalent of a postcard. Now, in the U.S., postcards do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy because it's very easy for someone just to turn over the picture and look at the writing on the back. Anybody can look at and record that information without breaking the law. So if the U.S. position is that emails that are used, these very popular email services, are the equivalent of a postcard, we've had this dramatic weakening of our legal infrastructure and the way it protects our privacy. So in short, in legal dimension, although China is not really very protective of its citizenry, there's not much difference in the U.S. in terms of practically what happens in online communication.
Now, in terms of the Chinese courts, we've seen in recent years some privacy cases actually coming before those courts. So just tell us about that. I mean, how significant are they in terms of movement within the Chinese system with regard to surveillance?
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's a very new phenomenon, but we are seeing, for example, people becoming incensed at the presence of CCTV cameras in particular locations. There are some recent court cases where students, innocent kiss was caught between two students who became very angry that this was recorded and have challenged that in courts. A lot of the privacy cases have to do more with the journalistic defamation than they do with surveillance of CCTV cameras, but that itself is increasing. And we're finding generally in China this increase in concern and actual action to support privacy among the Chinese citizenry, in particular this recent case with the Chinese blogger ID program. They wanted to have Chinese bloggers register their real names whenever they blogged so that it would be easy to trace back any problematic postings to the actual poster. And there was so much resistance within the Chinese community at many levels. There was software developed so people could create fake IDs. There was public resistance in blogs commenting that they really wanted to have their privacy and remain anonymous when making these comments. That very recently, the state government really caved into the demands of the public and said, you know, we encourage you to register your real name, but we will not require it. So there's quite a bit of interest in privacy, the nascent privacy movement, one might call it, in China.
Now, as you said earlier, there is a view that the surveillance of people in China is Orwellian. Just give us an idea, though, of how effective that surveillance is within the People's Republic as compared to the United States and the sort of surveillance that the growing number of cameras that we're seeing in the States, the growing number of surveillance devices that are being put in place in the States.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, when you look at actual practices that are going on, if you look at both surveillance cameras and the gathering of information from mediated communication, like people visiting websites or email communication, ever since September 11th, we're finding that there's an increasing tendency of private corporations to volunteer their data on their users are doing to state policing organizations, the FBI, the CIA, for example. And there are no laws against that right now. Again, the Fourth Amendment doesn't really apply to third parties who have information about you and what they do with it. So we're, as we learn, there have been a few recent landmark cases. There was a whistleblower case, an American communication technician who had witnessed the placing of a particular kind of equipment in the telecommunications facility in California that was basically inspecting all of the packets of information that were being transmitted over the internet and on the public telephones, and then probably doing keyword analysis or what have you. But there was no real restriction on the kind of surveillance that this equipment was doing. And we have an expectation in the U.S. that this kind of surveillance is really only authorized for terror cases or for particular foreign people who may be on the, in the U.S. at a particular time communicating with someone outside the U.S. Our laws allow that type of surveillance with a court-ordered warrant. But in this case, without a warrant, virtually all of the domestic traffic of telephone and internet that was going through internet, AT&T's pipes, was being fed to the NSA. So this was a particularly important case. It later came out that Verizon was probably also involved. We don't have specific evidence. No whistleblower has come out. But in the language, there was a case in Maine where citizens were asking Verizon to come public about its potential involvement with the NSA. And they refused to make a statement one way or the other. But from the wording of their statements, it appeared that they had been counseled by U.S. Attorneys from the Justice Department to word carefully that whatever they were doing was in the interest of national security. So we're seeing more and more examples of surveillance of this type going on in the U.S. There is certainly a difference between the two countries in what they do with the information. We have many more examples of dissidents being jailed based upon their emails, for example, in China. And frankly, there's no obvious evidence in the U.S. of this type of direct, apprehension of someone critical of the Bush administration, for example, being put in jail. But at the same time, there is beginning to evidence that, for example, the U.S. no-fly list. This is a list in the U.S. which is generated from data gathered from multiple sources. And people who are deemed to be potential terrorists or potentially cooperative with terrorists get color-coded in a way that they may not be able to fly that particular day. And there is anecdotal, not really systematic evidence yet, but anecdotal evidence of many, for example, Green Party members being forbidden to fly, being on the no-fly list, and other U.S. dissidents finding it more difficult to travel. So there's beginning to be some creeping evidence that U.S. is using this kind of data to interfere with the lives of its citizens.
Kenneth Farrell from the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania.